to get in the habit.
All right. Well, we've done our check-ins, and I'll just start by thanking you, Aaron, for that question. So I think there's a through line from your question to Luke's question. So I want to start with yours. The phenomenology exercises with the plant and the stone are a first pass, and we'll be working with the...
Ooh. Jeff, you're breaking up for me. Are you breaking up for other people too, or is it just like...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, dear.
Let me make sure everything's...
It's all plugged in. We just need to quit, probably.
Oh, yeah. All right, just quit.
Jeez.
You can quit everything. We're just tightening our bandwidth here.
Okay.
How do you do that?
Quit everything except for Zoom.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
What an idea.
Whoa. Now
I'm going to do the same.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. So, okay, now I'm going to try again. Can you hear me okay better? Is it any better now?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's probably some background process, and maybe we do it like that.
Yeah, and then I just want to have the window there just in case somebody else is waiting to join, because I don't just...
Participants.
Yeah, okay. We're good.
Okay, so... The question about the phenomenology exercise and how much time to allow for that. And so I would say my experience of these and similar exercises is that there is kind of a phase of moving from one attentional modality to another. And that's like the normal everyday kind of noisy consciousness to concentrated consciousness. And that sometimes takes 30 seconds, sometimes it takes 5 minutes, sometimes you can't even do it on that day. But you try, right? And what happens when you're in this exercise, the sort of the goal of this exercise is a very soft shift from looking at, you could say, to looking with. And so if you're looking at a flower, for example, and you're really taking it in without labeling it, you know, without thinking, oh, that, so not constantly bouncing back to your analyzing frame of mind, then you're just in a continuous state of noticing or seeing more and more detail, which will come with a certain feeling of awe or wonder or amazement or appreciation. There's a feeling or a mood there, which can then come into a feeling of or an experience of almost as if the flower is looking back, or as if your looking is not separate from the flower, right? So if you think about it logically, you know, Goethe said, what is the whole beauty of the world about except to be recognized by a human being, right? Why would the world need to be so beautiful if our recognition of it were completely separate from the world? So for him, our cognition, our noticing pattern and form and wholeness and harmony and his poetic appreciation for nature was part of the phenomenon that was showing up in him. It wasn't personal to him. It was part of the reality of those phenomena that he was participating in with his consciousness. And so the goal of the phenomenology exercise is to, in a way, feel this closed loop between the thing and its nature and its color and its form and how that is so constructed to reveal itself to your thinking consciousness, your noticing.
Can you just say that once more? The goal is
to feel, to have an experience of the closed loop, that the thing isn't what it is until it's seen. Right? And so the way that you get there is by looking without labels. You look closely enough that you kind of get into a zone of seeing without words and without labels and without analysis. And in, that's the state of consciousness that you're trying to practice, is just seeing. And you can have at a certain moment or a certain experience that experience of wonder or awe or aha, where that thing is appearing to you more and more fully, like you feel like you've seen it. And so this is a fluid exercise where there's not an end point where you're like, okay, now I've seen it, I'm done, but you're looking for a kind of experience where that seeing is really rich and saturated, and you feel the shift in your own mode from, you know, I've got a busy day and I'm going to do this exercise, to something else is going on with me and this little dandelion. Or this.
Are you saying there's a sense of oneness with the flower?
Well, there's lots of ways to put it in words, but I think what you're looking for is that felt shift from looking at to a more kind of comprehensive seeing, a true seeing of the thing that is there to be seen, so to speak.
Is that aha moment that you're describing, that sort of oneness moment, would you want to call that a goal, or do you not want to have a goal that you're sort of grasping toward?
It's like,
is that a thing that happens, or is that where you're aiming?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if you think in terms of a sponge, you know how when you fill a sponge and it's saturated, it won't take any more water. You can have a similar experience in your phenomenology exercise of seeing so much and so fully that it fills your sponge. And so if you've ever gone to an art museum, for example, and looked at a piece of art, you can see the same thing. You know, at first you're really noisy, and then you look at it, and then you see it, and then you realize there's more to see than you first thought. And yet you sit with it until you've quieted your thoughts, and you're letting it think in you. You're letting it reveal itself to you because you're quieter than you were when you started. And so that is kind of the goal. Now, if you have a goal-oriented mind, you might thwart yourself because you're trying to grasp at something. But you can also experience that sense of getting that sponge filled, like, wow, okay, I have really seen this object. And you know, then you can switch to the next part of the exercise, which is closing your eyes and visualizing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so this goes on until your sponge is full, until you're tired or you have no more energy, but if you come back to it later, even the same object or the same walk or the same tree or the same shell on the seashore, and you do it again, and then your sponge can be filled again. You know, you can see the thing afresh. And it's kind of this, what we're building towards is this conscious sort of filling up and emptying out of perception. And so there's no real need to do it for like an hour or half an hour even. You can do this in a few minutes. It's all about the quality of those minutes that you spend seeing, truly seeing, then truly seeing again, so that you know that if your own thinking is so quiet that it is revealing itself to you in ways that it wasn't when you first started looking at it, you've kind of shifted from not seeing to truly seeing, right? And that shift in your consciousness is what we're after.
So that's a cue, that's a clue, is when you begin to see more than you were able to see initially.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's definitely, okay. And if you notice the quality of your seeing or the quality of your attention shifts, that is a clue that your attention is very flexible and can itself metamorphose. So when you notice your attention shifting, notice that, because those are the attentional shifts that we're going to be practicing in this course, and there's no end to them, right? The attention itself can shift and shift and shift and shift and shift.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I think there's a natural breathing or process to it. There's a beginning, and then there's the middle as you strive for this shift and this sort of felt experience, and then it sort of ends, and as you practice or do it in a more rhythmical way, you'll feel the rhythmic quality of that, and you'll start to get into a bit of a flow with it and get a sense of, well, how long does it actually take you to get to a bit of a felt shift in your attention? So if you spend 5 minutes doing it and you only have 5 minutes because you're a mother, then you might get pretty disciplined about quietening down and, you know, hunting for that internal shift.
Okay.
Is it appropriate for me to make an observation or a question that's just emerging based upon what has just been shared? Is that okay?
Sure.
And it's what has come up for me is I'm thinking back to that video and the work of the guy who was the mayor. So what I'm thinking about is that whole thing that you just described, Jeff, and what it is to create something. So in the context of that story, he comes in and sees that there's a deadening of spirit, if you like, and so it splashes colour all over the city and tears down all the buildings that are ugly and shouldn't be there, because he senses that there needs to be an enlivening of people's imaginations and spirit. And so could it be that the people of that community, upon seeing this colour, even though they might not be attending to it in the way that you've just described, that something that's been created for them to participate in shifts them? It's not that they're as focused as maybe what we've been prompted to in this exercise, but I'm just wondering whether there's something about the world of creativity in that we're trying to create a way of seeing that other people might need to be enlivened towards.
You know, Edi Rama was a painter before he was a mayor. And the thing about looking at these natural objects is that our conventional worldview of Darwinism and natural selection does nothing to explain their form. And so it's always been a mystery since Darwin's evolutionary theory about why nature appears the way that it does. And in actuality, the forms in nature, the flowers, the spirals, the shells, the leaves, the insects, there's tremendous wisdom in how these forms become and metamorphose and how they distribute material and how effective they are in keeping the organisms alive. And so part of this is really learning over time to see that nature, that the wisdom in nature is speaking a language, right? So that was that whole thing about skull and skull language and flowers language. And so for Edi Rama, he knows from his experience that color has a language, that color has power. So it's not a theory for him, because he's dwelt staring at canvases like Aaron is staring at shells and flowers, right? He's done the phenomenology in the studio of seeing these colors next to each other, of letting them inform him of their nature. And so then he could make the leap to the gray buildings and the gray souls, which is a poetic metaphor, but also an apt picture, and the destruction of the churches in his home country, and all this communism, 70 years of communist rule, leaping to, well, maybe there's something existential. Maybe there's something wordless.
I have to go get Augie. I'll be back.
Yeah. Okay, on. Maybe there's something existential, spiritual, intangible, and wordless here that needs to happen. And you know, through his own stroke of genius, figuring out that these gray buildings could be the canvas for that. And so there is a link insofar as the world is always speaking to us. And we can use that as artists to say things that move people. And as social sculptors, we can use that to say things that move people to engage, for example, like Eddie Rama did, in a new level of civil dialogue. So this is really kind of a profound work in the ability of consciousness to dialogue and make sense of the world. And that is why it was remarkable when Eddie Rama did that work, that he did that survey. I don't know if you watched his TED talk, but he did a survey where he sent out a survey and found out that he asked two questions: how many people liked the colors and how many people wanted it to continue. And he found that he had a higher number on the second question, meaning there were people who didn't like the colors, but they wanted it to continue because it was bringing life and dialogue. Like, they couldn't care for the garish buildings and the patterns, and it was like, ugh, but they saw the effect it was having on society and they wanted that to continue. So he was working in these intangible areas, and the phenomenology is about building organs of perception and stillness and attention to work in those intangible areas. Because it's not theoretical, it's not in a framework, it's not intellectual, it's about this language of reality that speaks to the soul and to the intuition that we become artists in that realm.
Can you see why the phenomenology is so important? Based just on what you said, what Jeff said. Is that making sense?
Mm. Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm tracking, but I can go back and re-listen to what Jeff said. I see the little I checked. I see the little recording light flashing up here.
That's okay, because this is what we're going to cover in this course more and more, especially in module 3, but also in module 2 when we go into the shadow, is learning to see and perceive, really is probably a better term, what's there to be perceived, but which normally escapes our radar, normally escapes our attention.
Yeah, like Eddie Rama, it would not have occurred to him to paint the building, such a small, inexpensive project with such an outsized impact on a traumatized people. But because he had lived with the phenomena of color and its archetypes for so long, he was able to see and intuit in that realm. So that's sort of the gist of what Jeff was saying earlier, Aaron. Why it's so important to study archetypes in nature and in art, human art, phenomenologically in particular, because then we get to know this invisible realm in which we can then ourselves create in healing and transformative ways.
So, you know, in your work, Aaron, even just facilitating and listening to people and holding meetings, when you practice your phenomenology with the flowers and the shells, a large part of that is just shifting your attention into utter stillness and receptivity. And that long stretches of not knowing or of emptiness in which, however, you're not bored or distracted. And you can be completely receptive and attentive to a room without being flustered or worried or anything, because you know you've just done these practices that you can now transfer into your work.
You're on mute.
Sorry, I tried to unmute and missed the button. It echoes for me.
Thinking out loud.
What's that?
I thought you were just like thinking.
No, it echoes for me. I think what the current social and cultural moment is asking of us too, which is to listen in discomfort as long as we need to. Mm-hmm. To make sure that we are hearing what needs to be said.
Yeah, and we're not very good at it.
No, it's really uncomfortable.
And also but with also, the virus, you know, there's such a desire to solve. Is that Augie?
Oh.
There he is. Hello.
Hello.
Beautiful.
Hey everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
That's Luke.
Hello.
And that's Sue. Oh. And that's Louisa.
A little too intense for him.
So a lot of this is going to tie in during this course to the fact that when we've faced with a social problem in our culture, we want to solve it. And solving, most of the time, solving either doesn't do anything and it can often make things worse. So a whole century, last century, our grandfathers and grandfathers tried to solve lots of problems and make life more convenient with chemicals and roads and vision and cold wars and plastics, and you know we solve one problem and create 10 more, right? So the problem of solving has to do with not understanding the wholeness of the phenomenon.
Does that lead you nicely into Luke's question? Because I'm just keeping my eye on the time.
So
I think you can find a segue in there.
Yeah, so one thing here is that as you, like you could ask, if you're looking at this flower or this shell and your attention shifts to see more than you've seen before, one could ask, well, how is it possible that something reveals itself to me that I've never seen before and that I can make sense of it? If I haven't been taught this with a diagram and a teacher on a whiteboard, all of a sudden I'm seeing something now that is mysterious to me, but I can have a dialogue with it. I can wonder about it and I can see something. I can see a petal or I can see a turn in the shell. So there's something in my mind that makes sense of things, without me having to like think about them and figure it out. So what we're gonna get into in modules 2 and 3 is the subconscious, the superconscious, and daywaking consciousness. So we're gonna explore what the higher self actually is, but part of the higher self is our intuitive ability to make sense of reality. Our intuitive ability to create new meaning, you could say. And one can ask, where does that come from? So Luke, when you do the hard work of observing yourself in a habit or a compulsion or a closed loop, you see that happening and you interrupt it. You say, oh, I'm having a feeling, but I'm not gonna speak out of that feeling, or I'm not gonna act out of that irritation, for example. I'm gonna check that and I'm gonna get present. Then all of a sudden, all those energies, all that will, all those feelings, all those thoughts that were gearing up to go into that reactive cycle are now kind of free. And they're waiting your direction, right? And you have an opportunity then to give them new direction. And it doesn't, in my experience, it doesn't really, the hardest part of it is interrupting the habit or the compulsion, and the letting go is kind of not following through on your reaction, what you wanted to do, what you would have normally done. You let go of that reaction, and then something else becomes possible, right? Something else, some other way of responding, some other way of thinking, some other way of feeling. And that is when you get a little assistance. Because you don't, like in my conversations with Louisa, if she's saying something that is really annoying, because that's what she always does, and I'm just annoyed in the way that I always am, the easiest thing to do is to follow through with my dysfunction, but I know that it's not gonna get me the outcome that I want. I know that it's gonna be hurtful and that we're just gonna like end up in a bad place. So my work is to notice that thing arising in me and to stop it and to get present. And when I get present, there's another possibility that presents itself. And that is when I can have an intuition out of empathy, out of love, out of willingness, out of a softness to say or do or think or feel something else other than what was in the dysfunctional habit. And that possibility for the new thing is given to us by grace, really. It sort of appears. And that's kind of the upstream assist. That is where you're looking a little bit upstream and you get a little bit of grace because you don't have to do this time what you did last time.
But you have to sacrifice something.
You have to let go of the scratching the itch that wants to be scratched.
Yeah. And that can feel a bit like a sacrifice because we are often very much in love with our dysfunction. We're addicted to our dysfunction. So there has to be a sacrifice of the addiction itself. And it can feel like a sacrificial moment of like, I'm not going to get my way. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not going to be able to.
And maybe that's the effort that you were referring to.
Yeah, that's, in my experience, that is the effort.
Yeah.
And then the gesture of making room for the other person or having another idea, that's actually kind of more like play. That's more like playful improvisation and joy because you can't have the experience that, oh, I actually don't need to be an asshole this time. I can really genuinely shift my thinking and my behavior and actually genuinely value and understand. And boy, isn't she really smart and amazing.
Luke,
for me, I broke up just a tiny, tiny little bit when you said that the da-da-da-da is the effort. So what was the
sacrifice?
The sacrifice. Okay, thank you.
Sacrifice. Hey, Luke, what were you going to say?
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. A couple of things. I mean, one of the things that I've been sitting with is this whole notion of flow. So if I think about, you know, compulsions and habits from the context of, you know, ease, effort, things that get you stuck, things that create disharmony. Sometimes there's effort being put that leads to that from my end, as opposed to you think about, well, what's, you know, a good barometer is, well, what's allowing flow? And so that's just something that I've been thinking about. But Jeff, a couple of things. When you were speaking initially, what I was conscious of is, as being an educator, so predominantly in educating high school students, how quickly our education system educates out of people the capacity to trust intuition, to dismiss things that they perceive. It's actually, I don't know whether it's taught, explicitly taught out of people, but it's not attended to. And so that's a huge blind spot already. And so that's a real challenge. So that's one thing. The other thing I was conscious of is, as you were speaking, is this whole idea of, I'm very familiar from my own sort of background, I suppose, with being within from a Christian perspective, of certain texts where they're talking about this notion of a sacred yes, a willingness to go with a response and to say yes to it. But it's just as important to have a sacred no. You know, like, no, yeah. At this, I'm not going to continue, going to disavow this habit, this compulsion. And that, as you say, I think that's true. That's effortful. But in making that effort, hopefully over time, you just create more and more space through that sacred no for that sacred yes to lead you on.
Yeah. Yeah. And the more you practice, the less effort it requires, right?
Yeah. There's a really wonderful book that you might consider called Meditations on the Tarot by Anonymous.
I've heard of that book. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And the first meditation in that book is about the mage, is about the magician. And the principle guiding the magician's goal is concentration without effort.
Ooh.
And so it's a you know, back to Aaron's point, it's a looking and seeing that's a very kind of soft, receptive state of flow. And that's why I called it, that's why I said looking at versus looking with. You know, looking at has a kind of Mars, like I'm doing this to it. Whereas looking with is more like, you know, one of our teachers used to say, let thyself be seen, you know? It's really a honoring and a sacred or a gesture of wonder to relax and let something happen, let it be seen. So this whole idea of concentration without effort is there is a state of flow here that's willed or attentive. You're there, you're participating in it. You're if you weren't present and doing it, it wouldn't happen. But it's not something that you're grasping or holding, right? It's a soft will, not a hard will. And we'll talk about that in module 3 as well. And that is also present in meditation, where we're going to go in module 3 is in learning in meditation, gradually with exercises to be attentive and be present, but not forceful. That, you know, if you think about a gesture of listening to a loved one or just of holding your son there, Aaron, you know, the tenderness and the receptivity in your heart and, you know, you're holding, but you're not grasping. You're holding with a kind of utter receptivity. That's a gesture in artistic creation, in phenomenology, in which, by the way, Goethe called phenomenology delicate empiricism. It's a delicate looking carefully at things. And also in meditation, this very objective, very precise, but very soft and receptive way of paying attention. And all these things are the sort of the same gesture. And a lot of this program, we're going to be talking about the same things from different angles. So if we repeat ourselves, that's why. because when you turn upstream in your meditation, in your artistic work, in dialogue with your loved one, you know, coming out of that habit of having to win to truly seeing each other, the same soft looking, very clear, very structured. It's not like you're unstructured or woozy or flimsy.
Filmy-eyed.
Yeah.
Misty-eyed.
You're not misty-eyed and you're not like soft focused. You're totally clear, but you're receptive and sensitive, like one of those moths with those quivering antennas. You know, you're just like, you can pick up the smallest nuance.
And so you're suggesting, Jeff, that in our creative practice, that the mood to work toward.
There's a lot of different moods necessary in the creative practice, but in terms of looking, you know, Miha once said that creative practice was first demonstrated by God. You know, created the world, and then he stepped back and looked at it in Genesis, right? At the very beginning. So you do something and then you have to see it. And the part of the trick here is to see what's actually there, not what you think is there. And so that's looking upstream, that's in your meditation, that's in your prayer, that's with your partner, that's in phenomenology. That's an artistic practice, to truly practice perceiving in a way that is not colored by your desires or your fears or your habits. And this is just a practice. This is something that we just practice and practice and practice and practice. And it makes us more capable to work with others and to help them heal their dysfunctions and create creative spaces, generative spaces with each other in social life. That's really the point.
Well, my people, we are 4 minutes away from the top of the hour. So can we just pause there and do a round of checkout so we can hear your voices before we ring off? And just, it'll be good to hear what has landed for you, what has come up in you from today's session. You're all pretty familiar with my checkout takeaway thing. So who would like to start?
I can start.
Okay, go ahead.
Go ahead, Sue. Go ahead.
Okay.
I was just going to say that what's sticking with me is this softness.
Yeah, me too.
Because it's very much in my nature to go hard at things and to like really, you know, these train tracks I have right here are here because this is my... habitual, you know. So like even with the, you know, I just have had the time in the last few days to to start to go through the modules, but then I'm like, I'm gonna go through the modules, and you know, so just that softness I think is just needs to be on a big thing above my window here to remind me that things with softness is probably better than approaching them with this.
Mm. So. Cool.
Thanks, I too Aaron. Tend to go at things really hard, Aaron. And the soft and receptive are the two things that just really stuck out to me. And I was thinking, There's a listening part that I could be softer about when I'm writing. And I'm sure when I'm painting as well, but right now I'm writing. And and not trying to pull anything out of myself, but to listen in a soft and receptive way, to let things flow out of me rather than trying to push them out of a tube.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you, Sue.
Luke.
It's fascinating because I'm just sort of thinking, I'm wondering whether or not, I mean, hearing you guys say that there's a tendency towards being hard and directive and all sort of stuff, I think my sense has been, if I describe it, probably being, I've been soft, maybe too soft. And I think that there's a need for me to actually be not forceful, but to step into what it is that is emerging. Because what we've been talking about today, as I said at the start, has been, this is a real experience for me at the moment, that real shift. So apart from that, one of the things that I really want to acknowledge is just the fact that being here in Melbourne and observing, Aaron, what's the name of your son again? Sorry.
His name is Augustine.
Augustine. Okay. So it's obviously Augustine, but seeing him with you and Sue, seeing you here with your son and daughter, like just, I would hate to think the sort of conversation I'd be having if my mother was on a Zoom call with me and we were talking about wonderful things. I mean, she'd be fascinated, but it just
would cross a few bars.
Yeah. But you know, just wonderful. You know, we talked a little bit about that sense of receiving, and I can only imagine the journey that's happened with the people that are here in this call to be in this place. So that's just an amazing thing to be a part of, and I honor all of that. It's wonderful.
Cool. Thanks, Luke.
You know, what's coming up for me as we close is that, you know, if you, there's a great story about how Beethoven used to take long walks by himself. He didn't want to be interrupted. And that is where he composed. And so the contradiction here, you know, you think about Beethoven with the Fifth Symphony or the Ninth Symphony, you know, these bombastic and incredible pieces of music. And I love all the symphonies, but there's such a wisdom and a wholeness and a vitality in his music and a fearlessness. And so what does it take to be so receptive that one can fathom or hear such statements, right? So it's there is a softness in the receptivity, and it's not an impotent creativity that results from that receptivity. It can be a very forceful and powerful world-changing creative force. The softness comes in terms of softening ourselves so that we can hear or receive from inspiration, right, from upstream. And the reason it's important is that in our time, to your point, Luke, it's just, there's a lot of hardening in our culture, right? So I'm kind of walking away from the conversation just pondering these great artists that I really love, Goya and Beethoven and Picasso and so forth, and where they were also at the same time receptive and sensitive and open in order to bring what they brought. So a very interesting contradiction or paradox.
Yeah, and my check out is along similar lines, that, you know, in the discipline of something like music, you are constantly developing and building. It's a very hard will train track here exercise of developing technique. It's like 99% technique, but then you also have to at the same time be developing this antennae and receptor for the great idea with a capital I of the music that you're trying to play technically. And we never really got very much training in how to become this sensitive receptor, because the competitive nature of the music industry is diametrically opposed to building that kind of sensitivity. And yet the kind of artistry that Jeff and I are constantly trying to build in ourselves and that we really want to help our students develop is exactly that. This not only to hone your will to bring to life something, but also the ability to be equally as receptive in a very tuned and focused way to the archetypes and the ideas that are coming from upstream. Because we need both. We can't have an out of balance situation because then we just have commodities and entertainment.
Mm.
So that was my...
Mm.
Yeah. So anyway, we are...
Well, how do I listen to the recording? I need to listen to that again, Louisa.
We'll put it on the website.
Yeah,
that was beautiful.
Thank you. All right. Well, look, thank you so much, all of you, for showing up for this short and pithy hour. It's really wonderful.
It's lovely to be with both of you and with you too.
Yeah. So all of our love to you all. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you. Good to see you all.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, Augie.
Bye,
Aaron.
Bye.
Bye, Luke.
Bye, Aaron.